Hey Carnivore Theology listeners, we have a brand new contest for you. We now have Carnivore Theology t-shirts for sale with no profit to us. To buy a shirt, go to the website carnivoretheology.com and click on the t-shirt. To enter the contest, just post any picture of you wearing a Carnivore Theology shirt with the hashtag Carnivore Theology Shirt on any social media site like Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Check out carnivoretheology.com for all the contest details. Welcome to Carnivore Theology, a podcast that answers questions about the Christian faith to help you grow from milk to meat into wise, skilled, world-changing followers of Jesus Christ. With theologian and pastor Chad Graham, author and pastor Al Degeneau, and me, your host, Steve Bastian. Today's question is, Canada's Supreme Court has struck down the physician-assisted suicide laws. What does that mean and where does that take us?
Oh man, we've been driving forever. I'm so glad we stopped. Although I'm not so glad we stopped in Saskatchewan. Where are we anyway?
I'm not sure that your shortcut is getting us anywhere near where we want to go. What did that sign say, Steve?
Wilkie.
I don't even know that's how you pronounce it. Wilk?
I don't know. You know, it's not like Cadillac or, you know, all the other crazy names of Saskatchewan. Some of them are inappropriate to say without referencing that they're a name of something.
I like you're in Saskatchewan.
Yeah. Elbow. Yeah. I asked Siri where coffee was. It brought us here. So here we are at Corey's Diner in Wilkie, Saskatchewan.
I'm thinking this might not quite be a Starbucks.
No, it's definitely not a Starbucks. Although they got pie, man, so we can't. Oh. You can't argue with pie.
Pie and all you can drink urine from Saskatchewan.
Made of mostly water.
Definitely should not make fun of Saskatchewan. It's just that rural coffee is always disgusting.
I'm from Alberta, and therefore it's actually required of me to make fun of Saskatchewan.
I just make fun of writers.
Personally, I have a great deal of respect for Saskatchewan, and particularly to our Saskatchewan listeners. I just want you to know I'm your friend.
Best thing I ever saw was on Corner Gas, where the premier stood up and he said, "As you can see, Saskatchewan is a rectangle. Nature's perfect shape."
Nature's perfect shape.
Well, look, hey guys, something came out of the news last week, and I'm really trying to figure out how do I respond to this. Let me preface this. Do you guys remember that TV show Rick Mercer put it out, Talking to Americans? I think we watched it a couple times in college together. Americans are so dumb. We made our American friends watch it. And do you remember when he had a clipboard and he was getting people to sign petitions? Do you remember that segment on there?
Mm-hmm. I know exactly which one you're talking.
One of them was, and I looked this up the other day because I just had to know if it was just a figment of my imagination. Trying to get the Americans to sign a petition to the government of Canada to stop placing senior citizens on northern ice floes to perish. And that's so funny. Who in their right mind would put their senior citizens on northern ice floes to perish? And the Americans actually believe that Canadians were that harsh, and us and our igloos and dog sleighs would take our senior citizens up to the ice floe to perish. Well, it's not so funny anymore. The Supreme Court of Canada struck down the anti-physician-assisted suicide laws, and now our government has 1 year to figure out what those laws will be that will allow physicians to assist in end-of-life suicide.
I really appreciate how you were so careful to word everything. So what we're looking at is there were laws in the books from 1895 that prevented a physician from taking the life of his patient. Now what we have is the Supreme Court has struck that down and saying that because our Constitution guarantees, or the Charter, guarantees the right to life, it therefore, by some sort of twisted implication, means that our life is owned as a personal right, and we can therefore dispose of it as we will. And physicians, therefore, ought to be able to respect our right and to take our life from us. So that's what the real question is about. Should physicians be able to take the lives of other people?
Well, and you know what? I actually looked up online. I looked up the Hippocratic Oath, and it says, "I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody if asked for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect, And this is the oath that doctors have taken for years and years and years. I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody if asked for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect. So literally, they're going against tradition and, well, going against their own Hippocratic oath if they do this. They will do no harm, they say, and yet now they're saying, you know, that it's the right of the person to not only give a deadly drug to or something, but actually to make a suggestion.
Yeah, you know, I really find it difficult. I'm reading through, like, the CBC and newspaper articles, and they're really presenting this as a right. This is your right to choose when to end your life. Mm-hmm. It's your right. And my first response is that rubs me the wrong way, coming from a, I guess, right-wing Christian perspective. And that's where I come from, and, you know, I think we all kind of upfront put that as a bias that we have, but...
Well, I don't belong to the Canadian National Rifle Association, but...
As a right-wing nutter, this is our opinion, yeah.
You know, I really love you guys to explain what does the Bible say, what does historical Christianity and theology say around this, so that I can understand the meat of this conversation.
Well, Chad, I don't know what you want to say, and so I think we're going to take two very different tacks on this. I have a very philosophical view of what I want to talk about and what I would say to this subject, and I'm sure you have a historical, theological, biblical view.
Why would you think that sort of thing?
I'm just saying that we're going to take two different tacks on it, so I don't even know who's supposed to go first here. I'm so glad that they have bottomless coffee, because this could take a little while.
Bottomless urine. Fortunately, I brought my own tea, and I'm just boiling some bottled water here, and I'll soon be drinking a nice cup of Alpine Punch. It's a beautiful rooibos with vanilla extract.
How about Chad go first? Well, his tea is boiling and steeping.
That's right. True. I do have the time. I guess what I should say then, let me give a little context, and then I'll let Al talk for a while and give his opinion. This is an extremely complex subject, so even in our introduction, when we make it sound simple, the simplicity is... The question of euthanasia comes from two words, ev, which means good, and thanatos, which means death in Greek. So it's talking about having a good death. And this is rooted in Greek philosophical arguments, so this is nothing new. And for those of you who might know something about Greek philosophical schools, the Pythagoreans, from which you get like the Pythagorean triangle, the Pythagoreans opposed euthanasia, where the Stoics favored it in cases of incurable disease. Plato seemed to favor passive euthanasia, that is, allowing a sick person to die, but to oppose active euthanasia, that is, helping a sick person to die. And so we got to get into some of these different definitions, but let me just read to you what Aristotle says, because I think it summarizes the sort of main flow of a position in ancient Greece. In the Nicomachean Ethics, he states this, obviously translated into English. People seeking death are weak and depraved, the base among mankind, by toil overcome, conceive a love of death. But to seek death in order to escape from poverty or the pangs of love or from pain or sorrow is not an act of a courageous man, but a coward. And what he gets into is that suicide is an act of injustice. It's against the law, and in Plato and Aristotle's view, it's against the laws of God or the gods. Nevertheless, they still had an active debate until Judeo-Christianity became the dominant view in the West.
You actually reminded me of something that Fidel Castro actually said. Let me read you something. So this is December 1964, an official of the Cuban Revolutionary Government named Augusto Sanchez, he committed suicide. Fidel Castro issued the following statement. It says this, "We are deeply sorry for this event. Although in accordance with elemental revolutionary principles, we believe this conduct by the revolutionary is unjustifiable and improper, we believe that Comrade Martinez could not consciously have committed this act, since every revolutionary knows that he does not have the right to deprive his cause of a life that does not belong to him, and that he can only sacrifice against an enemy."
And that's where the debates really come down, is that idea of whose life is it? Who has the right over our lives? And so the point that I was going to transition to, that you did it beautifully, Al, is to say that the debate has always fallen down those lines. For Castro, it was essentially the communist revolution. For Plato and Aristotle, it was the principle of justice, which was enforced by the gods. In Judeo-Christianity, the whole debate changed and ended, because in Judeo-Christianity, there is an absolute view that God alone has the right to life. And principally because man is created and woman, man and woman are created in the image of God, which most people don't know, is a political and not a religious concept. The Old Testament was written into a particular world and culture, and the language that God used and that the authors of Scripture used to portray God's message was put into the language common people understood. And one of the principal things they understood were ancient empires. And in ancient empires, you didn't have telephones and computer networks. You had these vast tracts of land that might take weeks or months to traverse. And so when you had a province that you wanted to emphasize your authority over, you built an image of yourself there. And of course, we see these images scattered through the ancient world, images of Caesar, images of Alexander the Great, images of the pharaohs. And these images were placed strategically, for example, in the town square right over where the local government met. So that as you went to the local government, you recognized who was really in charge.
I've done the same thing in every room of my house.
Yeah, well, I would understand that. When the kids go to bed at night, they look down at the smiling, benevolent face of their father, and they know...
It's not smiling.
In principle, then, to be made in the image of God was a political statement that humanity represents the reign of God. And so to take away a life... or to take away the image of God, is actually an act of treason. Very similar to what Castro was speaking of, and that's why I found that quote so fascinating. It was just perfect. To take away a human life is to commit an act of treason against God and to deprive God of one of his image bearers. And that, of course, is the foundation for capital punishment given to Noah in the Noahic covenant. If a man's blood is shed by the hand of man, by the hand of man, that one's blood shall be shed, because man was created in the image and likeness of God. So this shut down the debate. So that's the basic history. There was this long historical debate, but with really strong positions on either side. The majority, I think, always favoring the right to life, or rather the inviolability of life. You can't take life. However, a softness to it, like Plato recognized, there are cases where one ought to be allowed to die. And then a minority position was, when it's too inconvenient to live, you should take your life. Judeo-Christianity came in and boom, basically swept it clean. Obviously, a couple of voices throughout history appealed for assisted suicide, but the Christian view has always been against it until today. And now our culture has run away as fast and as hard as it can from the Christian view. Really, I think, following World War II, and then particularly seen in the revolution of the 60s and 70s, as that change happened, the elements predominantly of individualism over and against creationism, there began to be a sense of personal sovereignty that usurped God's sovereignty. And with that done, why not take out the image of God? You've already denied his sovereignty. It's a political statement.
When I look at it, I try to put myself into the shoes of, in what mindset could this possibly make sense? To me, when I think of exactly what Chad has been saying, humanity is valuable. Therefore, to be able to kill someone or to take one's own life, how do you process that? And so as I sat and chewed on that, I think there's three main worldviews that have really brought themselves into our society that make it make sense to people. And so let me just give you those three, and even from their perspective, I think. The first one is independence. The second one is consumerism. The third is a fear of death. Talk about independence. This is a huge thing. Chad just talked about it. And the idea of every individual is their own God, and therefore they get to make the rules. Every individual is a master of their own destiny, and therefore they get to chart their own course. Every individual is special, and therefore their situation must be seen as a special case. Every individual is unique, and therefore an exception to any sort of societal ramifications. Individual choice is of the highest value, and therefore no one can make any choices for anyone else. The individual is always right when making decisions for themselves, and therefore their decisions, even those made from a place of pain or fear, must be right for them. So let us make heroes of those with the fortitude to follow through on the most individualistic thing imaginable, the taking of one's own life. That is a massive value in our culture. Individualism, and I just read to you the Manifesto of Individualism, and if you live in this culture, that makes total sense to you. Everything I just said is absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. That's just riddled in our culture.
And now, isn't that what we're hearing when we're reading all these newspaper articles Steve was talking about? It's that you are the captain of your ship. You know, you're the commander of your soul. You have the right. You have the destiny.
So how dare you tell me, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, let me throw another one at you.
Unless, of course, you're an unborn baby, then you don't have the right.
I'm trying my best not to get into abortion at this point because they are so tied together, these two ways of thinking. Now, the second is consumerism, okay, which is tied to individualism. Now, if life is all about accumulating as many things that we can that bring us pleasure and cause us to avoid pain, then it only makes sense that when pain is inevitable, life must be over.
Which is why the Epicureans had that view in the ancient world.
Right, so the terminally ill, they don't contribute anything to the economy, or at least not enough. They don't contribute to art and culture, they don't contribute to technology, they don't contribute to politics, or even family life. They are an emotional and financial burden to the healthy, and keeping them around actually costs more than they're worth. Therefore, since the consumer is in pain, and they are causing other consumers pain, and we can sell them nothing more to end their pain, the only thing we have to sell them is their own death, which allows up more resources for others and allows the sale of more products to assist with the grieving process. See, terminal illnesses, they take too long. In a world of immediate gratification, waiting to die or waiting for someone else to die is an uncomfortable countercultural thing that has to be sped up so we can get on to the next thing. So let us make heroes of those who are willing to end their own lives so that we can have more time and money to spend on ourselves.
Hmm. It's just incredible, Elvis. When you're saying these, you can understand, and we ought to do that as Christians. We ought to be sympathetic to that. If you put yourself within these shoes, you're not talking to someone who supports euthanasia. You're not talking to someone who's completely irrational, who's necessarily motivated by cruelty and malice. You're talking to someone who thinks differently.
It's a worldview.
And in their thinking, this is a perfectly... And they look at us and say, what's this crazy thing those Christians are doing? And I would say we both need to spend some time in each other's shoes, and this is helpful discussion. I think this helps us as Christians to think about how we discuss this with our neighbors and how the national dialogue should go forward. And if we're ignorant of them, we're going to sound ignorant.
Yeah, and I agree with you fully, Chad, that sit down, have those conversations, understand it's a different point of view, but I think our actions and how we deal with people suffering is going to carry the most weight.
Yeah.
So the last one, which is tied to the other two, is what I would call fear of death. Suffering and dying and death have no value or purpose. It is really the cessation of all things that have value because everything else is more valuable. Suffering, dying, and death have no value. Suffering, dying, and death is wasteful. Not in a good way, but wasteful in a bad way. See, religion has taught us to fear suffering as punishment for sin, and fear death because we face judgment, and everyone fears judgment. Hmm. Agnosticism has taught us that we can know nothing about what will happen after death, and the unknown always brings fear. Atheism has taught us to fear suffering and dying because it means that we are no longer the fittest, and therefore we have little or no value. And to fear death means that all we are and all we have become is now turned into food for something else. There is much to fear in suffering and death and nothing to gain. This world is all we have, this world is all we know, and that is all that is certain, and therefore any reminder of death must be eliminated. To counter that, we must worship youth and vitality and immediate pleasures. We must distract ourselves with any form of entertainment to keep our mind off of the inevitable. But the inevitable is, unfortunately, inevitable. So, when we are faced with death in ourselves or in someone else, we must deal with it the only way we know how, quickly, and keep it out of sight. Keep the dying away from us, and then dress up the dead to look more lifelike.
Hmm.
Only use death and dying as a reminder that we are still alive, that we must live all the more because we are still alive. One day, we will achieve immortality through science. Until that day, let us chase away the specter of death into the shadows. Let us make heroes of those who remind us of the youth, distract us from the dying, and who have the courage to keep us from having to witness death.
Yeah, I like that. Again, my previous thoughts are the same. We have to be winsome. we have to think about the way we deal with people. Jesus, we are told, grew up in wisdom and stature and in favor with both God and man. Jesus was winsome in the way he presented his stuff to people, even as he presented hard truths.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the winsomeness, of course, couldn't overcome the hard truths, and people rejected him for them. But it wasn't because Jesus was personally cruel to them. We think of the woman caught in adultery, and Jesus does tell her, sin no more. But he also tells her, I'm not going to stone you. And he gives her this shocking mercy.
Well, and each one of those that I just raised up, and there are certainly more, independence, consumerism, and fear of death, mm-hmm. each one of them really does have logical, mm-hmm. decent arguments mm-hmm. against what I just talked about. I mean, you don't just have to lay down Bible verses and yep. lay down Platonic and whatever truths and say, okay, well, this is sort of the philosophical reason. We actually can come down with good yeah. reason why we should be pro-life.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to answer Steve's question very plainly, though, and I want the average listener to hear some very, very simple truth. The Bible has essentially an extremely consistent worldview on this issue. I already pointed out we're created in God's image. So there's this particular expectation on the sacrosanctity of human life. Job 14:5 in the NIV says, a person's days are determined, you, God, have decreed the number of his months and have set limits he cannot exceed. One of the things in what Al was just talking about, that third category, is people desperate to avoid death, extend their lives. The idea is we can't extend our lives by a day. To the Athenians, Paul said that God, who made the world and everything in it, is Lord of heaven and earth, and he gives to us everything, life and breath and everything. That is, our lives cannot be extended 1 millisecond. After God has determined the end of our days. So sometimes these questions become a little bit moot, and I think what we need to do is realize to take a life in and of itself is always wrong, whether it's our own life or somebody else's. However, when we get into a modern period and we start talking about where this debate usually is, terminal illnesses, death with dignity, the kind of phrases we hear, I think we do end up in some very different grounds, and I would suggest that we will recognize two competing principles. One is that we don't go to someone and say, you're a little deformed, or you're a little sick, or you're very sick, or you're very deformed, and therefore your life isn't worth living, because of the image of God principle. Mm-hmm. They're still in the image of God, and it is God's life. So to take their life is to take something from God, to rob God. On the other hand, if the person's dying, we have the ability now to stick them on so many different machines and keep their body animate, it seems to me, nearly indefinitely now. Mm-hmm. Well, the person really is dead. We have not really extended their life per se. We've extended some animal function in the body. Mm-hmm. And I think as we're getting to that point, we need to realize again, you know, in all of history, people were dying very young. I think before 1960, less than 0.3% of the population reached the age of 85, and today we're somewhere around 2 or 3%. It's becoming much more common. And we got to realize, the part of that's good. So when we get to that point, those end-of-life questions, I would just say what we look at it is we have an obligation to do good, to relieve pain, and to help our neighbor.
Well, we could say it this way. We're called to try to care for the suffering, not eliminate the sufferers. That's a huge difference.
I like that.
Jesus, I didn't come up with that. That's someone else. But Jesus helped people who were suffering, yep. and he even accepted his own suffering, albeit with great pains in the Garden of Gethsemane. He accepted his own suffering because it was the best and the right thing to do, but he also helped people that were suffering.
And, you know, I made the point about the human dignity, but there's also a sense where suffering itself has meaning, at least in God's view.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
We talked about that just a few episodes ago.
Yeah. So I think as we look at that, there's no problem with Christians as we're considered. If you have a truly terminally ill person, we can basically define that. So I'm not talking about nebulous cases and this and that, or someone, everyone's terminal, you know, it just depends when. I'm talking about the cancer patient who's about done. It is totally permissible, I believe, within a biblical and Christian worldview to do all we can to help that person be relieved of pain. And sometimes those kinds of painkillers will hasten the end of that life. It's not a killing dose, but it certainly does hasten that because of the way they function. The weakened body, in other words, is unable to fight back against the medications, and so the death is somewhat hastened. So big difference from dropping a pulmonary embolism into this guy, but giving them proper medication, that we would not give to a child because it would do more harm than good. But in this person, you can't do any more harm anyway. We're not talking about knocking them off, but we may hasten their death because we have emphasized at that time of life the value of helping them take care of their pain and suffering. I think that's appropriate.
And we're literally talking about physical pain and physical suffering.
Yes, yes.
And one of the dangers of these conversations is the fact, and if you look at what's happening in Europe, is there's literally something now called euthanasia tourism, suicide tourism, because the definition of suffering, just like the definition of, you know, when it came to abortion, you know, the definition of health problems for the mother ends up being, you know, could be mental health problems, like undue depression or whatever, and therefore we have to abort the baby. What is suffering is going through a hard time. There are some countries in the world where a 12-year-old can commit suicide because they feel too sad. They feel like they should die.
Is that legal suicide,
And we're talking about physical suffering at end of life where the body is shutting down. And that's what we're talking about. Now, see, I'm not quite in line with where Chad is because we got to be real careful about hastening towards death because that's hastening towards the curse.
Yeah.
And that sort of denies the goodness of the process of suffering. Now, I'm not wise enough to know when that line is. We all have to be in serious amount of prayer as to when we're prolonging life. The news in the last week here has talked about two people that have come out of comas, one in 12 years, one at 20 years. We don't know. Right?
Yeah. No, and to keep in mind what I was saying, Al, just to clarify that, I want people to have a clarity or understanding that the idea of euthanasia is spoken of in so many different ways. And some people see euthanasia as, I have a person who's on a feeding tube and a breathing machine, and I unplug them, and their body passes away. That is covered under the scope of euthanasia today.
Yep.
Is that necessarily wrong because that person is dead except for those medical interventions, and those medical interventions will do nothing to recover them. They cannot be recovered. Again, we're talking about that person who is at the last stage of life, not the person who's been in an accident. We're working on different things. So what I'm saying, when we get in those categories, we should be sensitive to people and looking at what's going on in the real life perspective and not just say with absolute things, as long as some machine can be stuck in there to keep some synapses firing somehow, then we ought to do that. I don't know that that's necessarily helping that person in any way or... That's where I'm going at. Not persons got sick with cancer, so we might as well off them tomorrow. A very different perspective.
Or allow them to off themselves. I mean, we just talked about Brittany Maynard, right? I mean, she was just in the news for quite a long
time. Yes!
And her whole point in life was, well, I'm young and I want to live, and this cancer is preventing me from having the life I want. I am the master of my own destiny, therefore I will die however I want.
I will die before suffering kicks in.
Before that kicks in. And so
that's a different thing that I'm talking about altogether.
Exactly. I think we have to be, you know, we have to make sure that we are absolutely sure of saying that the process of suffering, the process of going through that, does have value. In fact, the idea of going through any kind of suffering, you don't have to fear death because Jesus conquered death. But suffering has a purpose, and dying does have a purpose. Even death has a purpose.
Yes.
We never grow more than when we're suffering. We are never more dependent than when we're dying. And we're never more completely in the hands of God than when we're dead. Each of these things has value. And to shortcut the process, I think, has its own inherent sin. Now, like I said, I'm not wise enough to know when that starts and stops or whatever, but we got to be real careful. I mean, if we're taking charge of our own self and our own independence, then I think we're sinning. I think that Brittany Maynard in that way was sinning because she felt she was her own God. You know, if we have a consumerist mindset where we're saying that this person is not bringing me value or my life is no longer bringing me the value I want it to give, I think that has sin. And if we're doing it in fear of suffering, fear of death, then I think that we really got to work through that. So I guess all those reasons can be bad. I don't know I guess I have a hard time understanding the pro reasons. I can kind of talk about the reasons not to do it. I have a hard time reasons to know when to do it.
What would you do, Al, with something like a living will or something? You know, people will say they don't use extraordinary measures and so on. I'll let you answer, and I'll tell you my view. I'm just curious what what's appropriate. Christians who are listening to this, or my family, who right now has grandparents who are both in terminal phases, and they have living wills on what they would like their family to respect. And so we're looking at, in real life, what do you do for grandma? What do you do for grandpa?
Making it totally personal for me, right?
Yeah.
We all live in fear of pain. Nobody wants to go through pain, especially long-term you know, lifetime of pain, type pain, or that matter, fear of losing our intellect and losing our you know, natural mental abilities. I think that's a pressing fear for everybody. And therefore, I would like my family to do what they can to save me. In a normal, and this is where it's hard, in a normal way, you know, do I want to back up healthcare to 1842 and only use whatever was available then? No. You know, I'm not sure I would go that far. But
do you want them to mortgage the house to fly to Mexico for some experimental treatment that's not approved by any medical organization? And
well, no, yeah, even that. I mean, do I want them to have me lie there for 40 years, having 25 machines breathe and process my fluids for me? In the off chance that I may someday, I don't know, you know, wake up. I don't think that's fair to the people around me. I don't think that's fair to my wife. I don't think that's fair to society because they're all paying the bills for it. I think there's, and this is just my own dark side of thinking, is that I think there's such a broad curiosity in the medical field of what we can do. That's not enough processing of what we should do, and therefore, because hospitals make a ton of money on this, and the government makes money on this, and doctors make money on it, maybe there's just too much consumerism in the mindset of people that are forcing these kind of machines on people. So again, like I said, I'm not sure I'm wise enough to know where that line is exactly. But I guess it's like what the old politician said about pornography. You know, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it.
That was a Supreme Court justice, actually.
Yeah.
And I kind of understand that, although I kind of think that can be a pretty bad argument because that's in the eye of the beholder, but it sort of is. And I think that's where we come down again. I say this sometimes, and I want to explain what it means. To me, this comes down to a wisdom principle.
Yeah.
Biblical worldview is quite simple. Generally speaking, euthanasia is wrong. So we should not seek to have our lives ended, nor should we seek to have other people's lives ended because of inconvenience, pain, suffering, these different kinds of things.
Or fear.
However, at the same time, we also only want to have done that which is reasonable and moral to preserve life. For example, we know that today, in some countries, organs are being harvested from prisoners to be given to the wealthy or to the in-favor people in order to extend their lives. Even questions about stem cell research. Most successful stem cell research happens from adult skin cells. There have been very few, very few positive steps made from embryonic stem cells, and yet, of course, the research still powers there. But there are a few instances where we've seen that, and would you want to participate in that? Those are the kind of questions where we have to have one-on-one discussions. And I think what's really important is, if you're a family member in this situation, you need to respect the Christian worldview and discuss this with your family member ahead of time. And then I would recommend to each believer that you write up a proper draft of directive what you want, not the one that gets tagged at the end of an average Alberta will, because that just puts it in the hands of the doctors. But you're going to give a medical directive power to a member of your family that you trust. And in there it's going to state that you would like them to make decisions based on biblical priorities, using reasonable and moral efforts to save your lives, and in consultation with a pro-life doctor to make those hard decisions when they need to be made. And you can have a lawyer help you to draft that up properly and make sure that a copy goes in your medical file. Because I think the world is just so different today, and we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And with all this technology flying around, for me just to say, you know, under no circumstance can you do this, but in some circumstances you can do that, that might change. And I want to be very careful on that. So euthanasia is generally wrong because we're created in the image of God. Extreme measures generally are futile because God's decided the day we're going to die. It doesn't matter how much money we spend or how bad we want it. Steve Jobs couldn't keep himself alive. But we have an obligation to care for our neighbor. We have an obligation to preserve ourselves as we are able to in order to preserve the image of God and to preserve others. And we need to balance those things in wisdom when we get to those true end-of-life questions. But as Al said, you know, voluntary abortions, voluntary suicides, if you can take a trip to another country and self-administer suicide, then you're not at that stage where it's more merciful to help with your pain than to, you're still a functioning member of society, for goodness sake, on just pragmatic arguments. You're robbing your family then. You're doing all kinds of unjust things, but I think that gives us a food for thought.
And I'll just tag on to the end there saying, keep in mind these are spiritual issues. We must remember that we're not an island. I'm not God. God is God. You know, we don't have the right to choose the time of our birth, our rebirth, or our death. Mm. Those are all in someone else's hands. We do not have the right to choose someone else's time of birth, suffering, yes, dying, or death. All those are the exclusive province of God. And so because we don't have the wisdom, we don't have the foresight to know what those kind of decisions are going to be, we need to take them out of our hands. And therefore, we give those to God.
Yeah. Right?
So let's look through Scripture. Let us look through and talk to wise counsel. And let us stay in prayer during those times. I know that fear starts taking over, and I know that worry starts taking over, and I know that frustration starts taking over, and there's just so much to process. So that's why it's so much more important to stay in the Word and stay in prayer so that you can be asking God, what do you think of this?
I want to recommend a resource. I took a class a few years ago by John Feinberg, and he and his brother Paul wrote a book called Ethics for a Brave New World. Highly recommend a resource that deals with all these kinds of issues in much more detail than we could. One of the things that makes it so practical is that the co-author of the book was given a terminal diagnosis, and his brother was named as his medical director, and they actually had to make these decisions and to walk them through, and he walked it through in the same principles that he expresses in his book. And so if you read that, you can see he not only has written about it in theory, he's lived it in practice.
That always means so much more to me when a book has someone actually ends up having to live that.
Yeah,
that just means so much. Hey, I recommend that we all run to the washroom, take turns, before we get back into the car and continue our road trip. But you guys, you've enlightened me further and given me more to think about of how I want to set things up even for myself, hopefully in a long time.
And you know, next time I don't think we should drive in an Austin Mini again. I think we need to get some kind of big old SUV.
Oh, dude, you have no idea how much I agree with you. This is not only do we carry our entire libraries with us, but we end up eating just the bad food, and we're just I've literally watched the mirror shake with Chad's intestinal fortitude. Like there's a problem there, Chad. We're gonna stop off somewhere. Now maybe just leave you on an ice floe to drift away. That's maybe where we should do.
Quit buying me with cheese and milk. I keep telling you, but you keep shoving stuff
out. Global warming is Chad's fault.
Have another Cheeto, Chad, he said.
The reason they're both complaining is because I get to claim which seat I take next. I was in the back. I get to choose where I sit, whether I drive or the front. So they're complaining because they don't want to be in the back. So
anyway. I just don't want to be behind Chad.
This has been Carnivore Theology with Chad, Allen, Steve. Thank you for listening today as we discussed physician-assisted suicide in Canada. To find out more about Carnivore Theology, or if you have any topics or questions you want us to cover on upcoming episodes, let us know by visiting us on our website, www.carnivoretheology.com. If you like what we're doing, please like us on Facebook, rate and subscribe to us on iTunes, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. We encourage you to connect with your local biblical church and keep your eyes on the cross. We encourage you to connect with your local biblical church and keep your eyes on the cross and your nose away from Chad.
Yeah. Bye.
Adios, amigos.
Bye. You're so slow. It's like you don't know it's coming.
I have no idea what you're doing. Why are you ending this podcast all of a sudden?